We call people who pick up on this mismatch perceptive or intuitive. Being able to read body language and compare it with someone's words is quite a skill. Research shows that women are more perceptive to body language than men. This is commonly called women's intuition. Women are equipped with more finely tuned sensory skills than men. As childbearers and nest defenders, women needed the ability to sense subtle mood and attitude changes in their children and others. That could signal pain, hunger, injury, aggression, or depression. For the first few years, a mother relies solely on the non-verbal channel to communicate with her child. So shuffling feet, lack of eye contact, and covering the mouth when fibbing is a dead giveaway. That's body language in action. Men, being lunch chasers, were never around the cave long enough to learn to read non-verbal signals or the ways of interpersonal communication. In fact, brain scan tests show that when a man's brain is in a resting state, at least 70% of its electrical activity is shut down. Scans of a woman's brain show a level of 90% activity during the same state, confirming that women are constantly receiving and analysing information from their environment. A woman knows her children's friends, hopes, dreams, romances, secret fears, what they are thinking, how they're feeling, and usually what mischief they are plotting. Men are vaguely aware of some short people also living in the house. Women's intuition is something that has always bewildered men who play around and invariably get caught. Few husbands can lie to their wives and get away with it. Conversely, most women can pull the wool over a man's eyes without his realising it. If you're about to tell a big lie to a woman, do it by email, not face-to-face, and not on the phone.
The culture in which you were raised plays a significant part, as does the context of the gesture or signal. Some gestures seem to be inbuilt. For example, blind children smile without having copied or learnt how. And across different cultures, the same facial expressions are used to show the same emotions. Some gestures may be genetic. When you cross your arms, do you cross left over right or right over left? Do you even know without trying it? This may well be a genetic gesture that can't be changed. Most of the basic body language gestures are the same the world over. Smiling, nodding in agreement, frowning or scowling are almost universal. The shoulder shrug is a good example of a universal gesture that's used to show that a person doesn't know or doesn't understand what you're saying. It's a multiple gesture that has three main parts. First, exposed palms to show that nothing's been concealed in the hands, hunched shoulders to protect the throat from attack, and raised brow, which is a universal submissive greeting. But just as verbal language differs, so can non-verbal language. A gesture used in New York or London may mean something completely different in Athens or Tokyo, and we'll cover this a little later on.
However, what you see and hear in any situation does not necessarily reflect the real attitudes people may actually have. You need to follow three basic rules to get things right. Rule number one for people watching is don't interpret gestures in isolation. Always look at gesture clusters for a correct reading. Like any other language, body language consists of words, sentences, and punctuation. Each gesture is like a single word, and a word may have several different meanings. For example, in English, the word dressing has at least 10 meanings, including the act of putting on clothes, a sauce for food, an application for a wound, and grooming for a horse. It's only when you put it with other words to make a sentence that you can fully understand its meaning. In the same way, a combination of non-verbal gestures invariably tells the truth about a person's feeling or attitude. This is known as a gesture cluster. If you compare their verbal and non-verbal sentences, you can make an accurate judgment about the person's attitude towards you. Let's look at a common gesture cluster, the one a listener assumes when he is critically evaluating what you are saying. Imagine your listener is sitting opposite you. His legs are crossed, his left arm is crossed defensively over his body, his right elbow is resting on the crossed arm with his index finger pointing up his cheek, while another finger covers the mouth and the thumb supports the chin with the head and chin pointing down. This non-verbal sentence says something like, I don't like what you're saying, and I disagree with you. The head position in particular infers hostility, and hand-to-face gestures indicate that negative thoughts are uppermost in the listener's mind, and in the right context, they give a clear indication of out-and-out lying. It could mean doubt, deceit, uncertainty, exaggeration, or apprehension. If you want to improve your reading of these gestures, you have to observe the movement of the hand and what part of the face it touches. Not only that, it's also helpful to keep an eye on the movements that precede the hand-to-face gesture. If you were to ask the listener to give his opinion of what you have just said, and he said that he disagreed with you, his verbal and non-verbal sentences would match or be consistent. If he said the opposite, that he was enjoying what you had to say, he would probably be lying because his words and gestures would be inconsistent. People actually rely far more on non-verbal sentences, so checking out their body language can be absolutely vital if you want the truth. Rule number three is always read gestures in context. All gestures should be considered in the context in which they occur. If, for example, someone was sitting at a bus terminal with his arms and his legs tightly crossed and chin down and it was a cold winter's day, it would most likely mean that he was cold, not defensive. If, however, the person used the same gestures while you were sitting across a table from him trying to sell him an idea, product, or service, it could be correctly interpreted as meaning that the person was feeling negative or rejecting your offer. Context is vital and must always be considered when analysing body language. Physical restrictions or disabilities are also a consideration. Your colleague with a dead fish handshake may just have arthritis and be avoiding the pain of a strong grip.
Let's now talk about specific body language. Firstly, a new form of palm reading. There are more connections between the brain and the hands than between any other body parts. Few people ever consider how their hands behave or the way they shake hands when they meet someone. Yet those first 5 to 7 handshake pumps establish whether dominance, submission, or power plays will take place. The open palm is associated with truth, allegiance, and submission. For example, the palm of the hand is the focus when making oaths or giving evidence in a court of law. If you want to discover whether someone's being open and honest or not, watch for palm displays. When people want to be open and honest, they'll often hold one or both palms out to the other person and say something like, "I didn't do it," or "I'm sorry I upset you." Like most body language signals, this is a completely unconscious gesture and one that gives you an intuitive feeling or a hunch that the other person is telling the truth.
Men and women behave differently when trying to conceal things, but if you watch what their hands are doing, all will be revealed. A man who wants to keep quiet about an illicit night out might hide his palms in his pockets, a common sign that a man doesn't want to participate in a conversation, or in an arm cross position when he tries to explain to his partner where he was. However, the hidden palms may give her an intuitive feeling that he is not telling the truth. A woman with something to hide will try to avoid the subject or talk about a range of unrelated topics while simultaneously busying her hands with various other activities. So does this mean if you keep your palms visible at all times you are likely to be believed? Well, yes and no. If you tell an outright lie with your palms exposed, you might still appear insincere because many of the other gestures that should also be visible when displaying honesty are absent. Not only that, the negative gestures used when you lie will appear and will be incongruent with the open palms. Remember the rules of gesture clusters and congruence. You may actually find it difficult to lie convincingly if you're using an open palm gesture, as your gestures and emotions are closely linked.
One of the least noticed but most powerful body signals is given by the human palm when someone is giving directions or commands and in handshaking. When used in a certain way, palm power invests its user with the power of silent authority. There are three main palm command gestures: the palm up position, the palm down position, and the palm closed, finger pointed position. Let's say that you ask someone to move something for you. We'll assume that you use the same tone of voice, the same words and facial expressions in each example, and that you change only the position of your palm. The palm facing up is used as a submissive, non-threatening gesture, reminiscent of the pleading gesture of a beggar, and from an evolutionary perspective, it shows that you hold no weapons. The person being asked to move the item will not feel threatened by your request when you use the palm up position. When the palm is turned to face downwards, you now project immediate authority. The other person will sense that you've given them an order to move the item, and they may even begin to feel antagonistic towards you, depending on your relationship with him or the position you have with them in a work environment. For example, if the other person was someone of equal status, he might resist a request with the palm down, but would be more likely to comply if you'd used your palm up. If the person is your subordinate, the palm down position is seen as acceptable because you have the authority to use it. The palm closed finger pointed gesture is a fist where the pointed finger is used. It subconsciously arouses negative feelings in others. This gesture is one of the most annoying anyone can use while speaking, particularly when it beats in time with the speaker's words. In some countries, such as Malaysia and the Philippines, finger pointing at a person is an insult, as this gesture is only used to point at animals. Malaysians will often use their thumb to point at people or to give directions. In an experiment with 8 lecturers, we found that those who mostly used the palm up position received 84% positive testimonials from their participants, and this dropped to 52% when they delivered the same presentation to another audience using mainly the palm down position. The finger pointed position recorded only 28% positive response, and some participants even walked out during the lecture. If you know that you occasionally finger point during presentations, try practicing the palm up and palm down positions, and you'll find that you can create a more relaxed atmosphere and have a far more positive effect on others. Alternatively, if you squeeze your index finger against your thumb to make an okay type gesture and talk using this position, you'll come across as authoritative but not aggressive. We taught this gesture to groups of speakers, and we measured the audience reactions. The audiences who listened to the speakers who use this gesture described those speakers as thoughtful, goal-oriented, and focused.
Shaking hands is a relic of our ancient past when tribes held out their hands to show that no weapons were being held or concealed. In most Western countries today, it is performed both on greeting and on departure in all business contexts, and increasingly at social events by both men and women. Even in Japan, where bowing has been the norm, handshakes are now widely used. So what should we look for in handshakes? Should you reach first? How many pumps should you give? Is strong better than weak? Let's assume that you have just met someone for the first time and you greet each other with a handshake. One of three basic attitudes is subconsciously transmitted by that handshake. 1. Dominance. Your reaction to this handshake is, "He's trying to dominate me. I'd better be cautious." You transmit dominance by turning your hand so that your palm faces down in the handshake. Your palm doesn't have to face directly down, but it's the upper hand and communicates that you want to take control of the encounter. You literally have the upper hand. 2. Submission. If you're on the receiving end of a submissive handshake, you think, "I can dominate this person. He'll do what I want." Submission is when you shake your hand with your palm facing upwards, symbolically giving the other person the upper hand. This can be effective if you want to give the other person control or allow him to feel that he is in charge of the situation, for example, if you were trying to make an apology. 3. Equality. You think, "I feel comfortable with this person." When two dominant people shake hands, a symbolic power struggle takes place as each attempts to turn the other's palm into the submissive position. The result is a firm handshake with both palms remaining in the vertical position, and this creates a feeling of equality and mutual respect because neither is prepared to give in to the other. Remember that the handshake evolved as a gesture to say hello or goodbye or to seal an agreement, so it always needs to be warm, friendly, and positive. There are two key ingredients for creating rapport in a handshake. First, make sure that yours and the other person's palms are both in a vertical position so that no one is dominant or submissive. Second, apply the same pressure you receive. Also keep in mind that the average male hand can exert around twice the power of an average female hand, so make allowances. Power and control issues are less important to women, which probably accounts for why few women use the upper hand ritual. Research has revealed that some women will give men a soft handshake in some social situations to imply submissiveness in order to highlight their femininity. In a business context, however, this approach can be disastrous for a woman. Women who display high femininity in business meetings are not taken seriously by other businesswomen or men, despite the fact that it's now fashionable or politically correct to say everyone is the same.
If you're on the receiving end of an aggressive palm-down handshake, there are ways that you can counter it. Don't try to turn the other person's palm back up. It's obvious what you're doing. Instead, step forward on your left foot as you reach to shake hands. This takes a little practice because stepping forward on the right foot is the natural position for 90% of people when shaking with the right hand. Next, step forward with your right leg, moving across in front of the person and into his personal space. Finally, bring your left leg across to your right leg to complete the maneuver, and then shake the person's hand. This tactic allows you to straighten the handshake or even turn it over into a submissive position. It almost feels as if you're walking across in front of him and is the equivalent of winning an arm wrestling bout. It also allows you to take control by invading his personal space. It's a nifty technique when dealing with overbearing, dominant types. Another solution to the dominant handshake is to respond with your hand in the palm-up position and then put your left hand over his right to form a double hander and to straighten the handshake in a kind of hand sandwich. This switches the power from him to you and is a much simpler way of dealing with the situation, and it's much easier for women to use. Another unpopular handshake is the clammy handshake. Nervousness causes the blood to drain away from the outer layer of the skin on the hands. The result is that our hands lose temperature and begin to sweat, making them feel cold and clammy, resulting in a handshake that feels like a wet salmon. Keep a handkerchief in your pocket or handbag so that you can dry your palms immediately before meeting someone so that you don't make a poor first impression. The battle of the handshakes can often be seen on television news bulletins when two leaders stand beside each other for photographs. The one who stands to the left of the picture is perceived by the viewers to have a dominant edge over the other, as he can operate the powerful upper hand handshake. The double hander is sometimes called the politician's handshake. The initiator of the double hander tries to give the impression he's trustworthy and honest, but when it's used on a person he's just met, it can have the reverse effect, leaving the receiver feeling suspicious about the initiator's intentions. Other examples of controlling handshakes on our handshake hit list are, in order of control, the elbow grasp. This is where the shaker uses his left hand to grasp the elbow of the shakee. There's the wrist hold, where the shaker grabs the shakee's wrist. The shoulder hold, that's where they grab the shakee's shoulder. And finally, the upper arm grip, where the shaker leans forward and grasps the upper arm of his unfortunate victim. With these handshakes, the initiator is attempting to show an intimate connection with the receiver while, at the same time, attempting to control their movement. All these handshakes invade your personal space to some degree. So, if you don't have some sort of personal bond with the other person, don't use any double-hander. And if the person who gives you one doesn't have a personal connection with you, look for their hidden agenda.
To summarise, the most important thing to remember is always to give notice to the others that you intend to shake hands so as not to catch them off guard. Hold your hand out as early as possible to give clear notice of your intention to shake hands, and this will avoid any fumbling. Keep your hands vertical and don't invade anyone's personal space. Also, you must be aware of the context of the shake, particularly with a soft or limp handshake. Maybe they have arthritis or work with their hands, such as an artist, surgeon or musician, and prefer a soft handshake to a firm grip.
Learning to read arm signals is another important consideration when translating someone's body language. Hiding behind a barrier is a response we learn at an early age to protect ourselves. As children, we hid behind furniture and our mother's skirt whenever we found ourselves in a threatening situation. As we grew older, this hiding behaviour became more sophisticated, and by the age of 6, we learned to fold our arms tightly across our chests whenever a threatening situation arose. During our teens, we learned to make the crossed arms gesture less obvious by relaxing our arms a little and combining the gesture with crossed legs. As we grow older, the arm crossing gesture can evolve to the point where we try to make it even less obvious to others. By folding one or both arms across the chest, a barrier is formed that is an unconscious attempt to block out what we perceive as a threat or undesirable circumstances. The arms fold neatly across the heart and lungs region to protect these vital organs from being injured, so it's likely that arm crossing is inborn. One thing's certain, when a person has a nervous, negative or defensive attitude, it's very likely that he will fold his arms firmly on his chest, showing that he feels threatened. This is an obvious sign to look out for. Tests have revealed that when a listener folds his arms, not only does he have more negative attitudes about the speaker, he's also paying less attention to what's being said. It's for this reason that training centres should have chairs with arms on them to allow the attendees to leave their arms uncrossed. Some people argue that they habitually cross their arms because they're comfortable. But let's be realistic. Any gesture will feel comfortable when you have the corresponding attitude. That is, if you have a negative, defensive or nervous attitude, folded arms will feel comfortable. If you're having fun with your friends, folded arms will feel uncomfortable. Remember that with all body language, the meaning of the message is also in the receiver as well as the sender. You may feel comfortable with your arms crossed and your back and neck stiffened, but studies have shown that others' reactions to these gestures are negative. So the lesson here is clear. Avoid crossing your arms under any circumstances unless your intention is to show others that you don't agree or that you don't want to participate. There are also gender issues to consider here. Men's arms rotate slightly inwards while women's arms rotate slightly outwards. These rotation differences have enabled men to aim and throw more accurately, while women's splayed elbows give them a wider, more stable position for carrying babies. One interesting difference is that women tend to keep their arms more open when they're around men they find attractive and are more likely to fold their arms across their breasts around aggressive or unattractive men.
There are many arm folding positions and we'll discuss here the most common ones you're likely to see. Crossed arms on the chest is universal and is decoded with the same defensive or negative meaning almost everywhere. It is commonly seen among strangers in public meetings, in queues or cafe lines, in elevators, or anywhere that people feel uncertain or insecure. When you see someone taking the arms cross position, it's reasonable to assume that you may have said something with which they disagree. It may be pointless continuing your line of argument, even though a person could be verbally agreeing with you. The fact is that body language is more honest than words. Your objective should be to try and work out why they cross their arms and try to move the person into a more receptive position. The attitude causes the gesture to occur, and maintaining the gesture forces the attitude to remain. A simple but effective way of breaking the arms folded position is to give the listener something to hold or give them something to do. Giving them a pen, book, brochure or written test forces them to unfold their arms and lean forward. This moves them into a more open position and therefore a more open attitude. Asking someone to lean forward to look at a visual presentation can also be an effective means of opening the arms folded position. You could also lean forward with your palms up and say, "I can see you have a question. What would you like to know?" Or, "What's your opinion?" You then sit or lean back to indicate that it's their turn to speak. By using your palms, you non-verbally tell them that you would like them to be open and honest because that's what you're being.
A cluster to watch out for is if a person has clenched fists as well as a full arm cross. This cluster, called fist clenched, arms crossed, shows hostility as well as defensiveness. If it's combined with a tight-lipped smile or clenched teeth and red face, a verbal or even physical attack could happen. A conciliatory approach is needed to discover what's causing it if the reason is not already apparent. This person has an aggressive, attacking attitude, so be careful how you proceed. Another variation of the crossed arms position is the double arm grip, which is characterized by the person's hands tightly gripping their upper arms to reinforce themselves and avoid exposure to the front of the body. It's a person's way of comforting himself with a form of self-hugging. Arm gripping is commonly seen in dentists and doctors' waiting rooms or with first-time air travellers who are waiting for liftoff. It shows a negative, restrained attitude.
One area where handshakes, kissing and bear hugs have not become established is Japan, where such bodily contact is considered impolite. Japanese people bow on the first meeting, the person with the highest status bowing the least, and the one with the least status bowing the most. On first meeting, business cards are exchanged, each person assesses the other's status, and appropriate bowing follows. A top tip for when you go to Japan is to make sure your shoes are spotlessly clean and in good condition, as every time a Japanese bows, he inspects them. The Japanese way of listening to someone involves a repertoire of smiles, nods, and polite noises, which have no direct equivalent in any other language. The idea is to encourage you to keep on talking, but this is often misinterpreted by Westerners and Europeans as agreement. The head nod is an almost universal sign for yes, except for the Bulgarians who use the gesture to signify no, and the Japanese who use it for politeness. If you say something a Japanese doesn't agree with, he'll still say yes or hai in Japanese to keep you talking. A Japanese yes usually means yes, I heard you, and not yes, I agree. For example, if you say to a Japanese person, you don't agree, do you? He will nod his head and say yes, even though he may not agree. In the Japanese context, it means yes, you are correct, I don't agree. The Japanese are concerned with saving face and have developed a set of rules to prevent things going wrong, so try to avoid saying no or asking questions where the answer might be no. The closest a Japanese will get to saying the word no is, it is very difficult, or we will give this positive study, when they really mean let's forget the whole thing and go home.
A cultural difference which can really get a strong reaction is nose blowing. Europeans and Westerners blow their noses into a handkerchief or tissue, while Asians and Japanese spit or snort. Each is appalled by what they see as the other's disgusting behaviour. This dramatic cultural difference is the direct result of the spread of tuberculosis in past centuries. In Europe, tuberculosis was the AIDS of past centuries, so governments instructed people to blow their nose to avoid further spreading the disease. This is why Westerners react so strongly to spitting. A spitting person could spread tuberculosis around, so people were as alarmed by that prospect as they would be if you could spread AIDS by spitting. If tuberculosis had been a problem in Eastern countries, the cultural reaction would be the same as with Westerners. As a result, the Japanese are appalled when someone produces a handkerchief or tissue and blows their nose into it and puts it back into their pocket or their purse or up their sleeve. Japanese are unimpressed at the English custom of men wearing a handkerchief in their jacket top pocket. This is the equivalent of proudly dangling a roll of toilet paper from your pocket, ready for action. Asians believe, correctly, that it is a healthier option to spit, but it's a habit that's repulsive to Westerners and Europeans. This is why business meetings between Westerners and Europeans can fail when they've all got a cold. So don't feel upset by an Asian who spits or snorts, and never blow your nose in front of a Japanese person.
As we discussed before, a gesture used in London or New York may mean something completely different in Athens or Tokyo. Let's look at three common hand gestures used all over the world: the ring gesture, the thumbs up, and the V sign. The ring, or OK gesture, where the palm faces out, the thumb and the forefinger meet at their tips, and the three remaining fingers are splayed out, was popularized in the USA in the early 19th century. Although what OK stands for has been lost in the midst of time, the gesture and its meaning is common to all English-speaking countries. However, in France it means zero or nothing. In Japan it means money. In some Mediterranean countries, its use infers that a man is homosexual, so if in Greece or Brazil, don't use this gesture unless you want to upset the locals. In Britain, the US, Australia and New Zealand, the thumbs up gesture means everything's okay or great. It is also used by hitchhikers, Hence the expression thumbing a lift. If you were brought up on the continent of Europe, however, the thumbs up signal means one, as continentals start counting using their thumb first rather than their index finger. In Greece, its use is different again, and here its meaning is abusive. Thrusting the thumb sharply forward means get stuffed, or a similar phrase that involves sex and travel. So don't hitchhike in Greece, or you could get yourself into trouble.
While Winston Churchill's palm facing out V sign meant victory, the palm facing in V sign has an impolite get stuffed meaning in Australia, New Zealand and Britain. However, on the continent, the palm in V sign still means victory in many places. So if you're going to try to insult one of our European friends by giving him a get stuffed V sign, he may walk away wondering what victory you're referring to. It also means the number two in the USA, so giving a barman a V sign there may result in getting a couple of beers.
Whether or not someone will be offended by being touched during conversation depends on his or her culture. For example, the French and the Italians continually touch as they talk, while the British prefer not to touch at any time unless it's on a sports field in front of a large audience. Intimate embracing by British, Australian and New Zealand sportsmen is copied from South American and continental sportsmen who embrace and kiss each other after a goal is scored and continue this intimate behaviour in the dressing rooms. The moment the Aussies, Brits and Kiwis leave the field, it reverts to the hands-off or else policy. Dr. Ken Cooper studied touch frequencies in a number of countries and recorded the following results for touches per hour. Puerto Rico, 180, Paris, 110, Florida, 2, London, 0. It is very easy to inadvertently offend someone from another culture. But remember, people do business with people who make them feel comfortable, and successfully negotiating a deal can come down to sincerity and good manners in the end. So when entering a foreign country, concentrate on reducing the broadness of your body language until you have the opportunity to observe the locals. If you're not sure about how to be polite in someone else's culture, ask the locals to show you how things are done. Cultural misinterpretation of gestures can produce embarrassing results, and a person's background should always be considered before jumping to conclusions about the meaning of his or her body language and gestures.
Disc 2. Let's now talk about thumb displays. As mentioned earlier, thumbs denote superiority. In palmistry, the thumbs represent strength of character and the ego, and body language signals involving the thumbs also show self-important attitudes. Thumbs are used to display dominance, assertiveness, and sometimes aggressive attitudes. Thumb gestures are secondary gestures and are usually part of a larger cluster. Thumb displays are positive signals, often used in the typical pose of the cool individual who uses them to show superiority. A man will use protruding thumbs around women to whom he's attracted, and people who wear high status or prestige clothing also display their thumbs. You'll rarely see a low status individual, such as a vagrant, doing it. The thumbs protruding from the coat pocket gesture is common to men and women who feel they're in a superior position to others. One of Prince Charles's regular gestures, and reveals the in-control attitude he feels at the time. In a work environment, the boss will walk around the office with this position, and when the boss is away, the person who is next in charge will walk around using it. But none of the subordinates would dare do it in front of the boss. Arms folded with thumbs pointing upwards is another common thumb cluster. This is a double signal, showing a defensive and negative attitude, that is, the folded arms, plus a superior attitude revealed by the thumbs. The person using this cluster usually gestures with his thumbs as he talks and rocks on the balls of his feet when standing. The thumb can also be used as a signal of ridicule or disrespect when it's used to point at another person. For example, the husband leans across to his friend, points towards his wife with his thumb and says, "She always nags," is inviting an argument with her. In this case, the thumb is used as a pointer to ridicule her. Consequently, thumb pointing is irritating to most women, particularly when a man does it. Thumb pointing is not common amongst women, although they sometimes use it to point at people they don't like. The thumbs have been used as a sign of power and authority for thousands of years. In Roman times, the thumb held up or down meant life or death to a gladiator. Even without any training, others intuitively decode thumb signals and seem to understand their meaning. Look for them next time you're out anywhere in public. You are now in a position not only to decode thumb signals, but to train yourself to use them.
Now let's look at the hand-to-face gestures. These gestures are important to understand as they are powerful indicators of how truthful people are being. If you told everyone the complete truth all the time, you'd not only end up lonely, you might even finish up in hospital or prison. For example, to your boss.
Good morning, boss, you talentless slob.
To your mother-in-law.
So nice to see you, you interfering negative old bat.
When a woman says, "Does this dress make me look fat?" what is your answer? If you're a man and you know what's good for you, you'd say she looks good. But you might have been thinking, the dress doesn't make you look fat, it's all the cake and ice cream you eat that makes you look fat. Let's face it, lying is the oil that greases our social interactions with others and lets us maintain friendly relationships. These are called white lies because their goal is to make others feel comfortable instead of telling them the cold, hard truth. Research shows that social liars are more popular than those who continually tell the truth, even though we know the social liar is lying to us. The most reliable clues to lying are not the words that are spoken, but the gestures a person automatically makes, because they have little or no control over them. So how can you tell when someone is lying, stalling, or simply thinking it over? Recognition of deceit, procrastination, boredom, and evaluation gestures can be some of the most important observation skills you can learn. In this section, we'll teach you the body language signals that give people away. The three wise monkeys symbolize those who hear no evil, see no evil, and speak no evil. Their simple hand-to-face gestures form the basis of the human deceit gestures. In simple terms, when we see, speak and hear lies or deceit, we are likely to attempt to cover our mouth, eyes or ears with our hands. People who hear bad news or witness a horrific accident will often cover their entire face with their hands to symbolically stop themselves from seeing or hearing the awful news. This was the gesture that was most observed worldwide when people heard about the planes flying into the Twin Towers on September 11th, 2001. As we've already said, children often use hand-to-face gestures openly when they lie. If a child tells a lie, he will often cover his mouth with one or both hands in an attempt to stop the deceitful words from coming out. If he doesn't want to listen to a reprimanding parent, he simply covers his ears with his hands to block out the noise. When he sees something he doesn't want to look at, he covers his eyes with his hands or his arms. As he becomes older, these hand-to-face gestures become quicker and less obvious, but they still occur when he is lying, covering up, or witnessing deceit.
As we've said, although we'll be analysing gestures in isolation and discussing them individually, this is not how they usually occur. They're part of a larger gesture cluster and should be analysed as such. When someone is using a hand-to-face gesture, it doesn't always mean that he's lying. It does indicate, however, that the person could be holding back information, and further observation of other gesture clusters can confirm or deny your suspicions. It's important that you avoid interpreting a single hand-to-face gesture in isolation. While there is no single guaranteed facial movement or expression that confirms someone's telling a lie, there are several gesture clusters that you can learn to recognise which will dramatically increase your chances of spotting a lie. The face is used far more than any other part of the body to cover up lies. We use smiles, nods and winks in an attempt to cover up. But unfortunately for us, our body signals will tell the truth when there's a lack of congruence between our body gestures and our facial signals. Our attitudes and emotions are continually revealed on our faces, and we are completely unaware of it for most of the time. When we're going to try to conceal a lie, or a certain thought flashes into our mind, it can be shown for a split second on our face. We usually interpret someone's quick nose touch as an itch, or that when they rest their hand on their face, they're deeply interested in us, without ever suspecting that we're boring them to death. Every presenter knows the empty feeling that results when he or she is giving a presentation to someone who says very little and just sits there watching. Fortunately, there are a number of hand-to-cheek and hand-to-chin gestures that can be used as a type of thermometer to test how hot or cold the person's attitude is and which tell the speaker how well he's doing. When the listener begins to use his hand to support his head, it's a signal that boredom has set in and his supporting hand is an attempt to hold up his head to stop himself from falling asleep. The degree of the listener's boredom is related to the extent to which his arm and hand are supporting his head. The ultimate boredom signal occurs when the head is fully supported by the hands. The sound of snoring is also a bit of a clue. Signals like drumming the fingers on the table and continually tapping the feet on the floor are often misinterpreted by professional speakers as boredom signals. In fact, they signal impatience. If you see these signals when you're addressing a group of people, a strategic move must be made to get the finger drummer or foot tapper involved in the conversation to avoid his negative effect on other listeners. Any audience that displays boredom and impatience signals together is telling the speaker that his time is up.
Evaluation is shown by a closed hand resting on the chin or cheek, often with the index finger pointing upwards. When the person begins to lose interest but still wants to appear interested for courtesy's sake, the position will alter so that the heel of the palm supports the head as boredom sets in. Genuine interest is shown when the hand lightly rests on the cheek and is not used as a head support. When the index finger points vertically up the cheek and the thumb supports the chin, the listener is having negative or critical thoughts about the speaker or his subject. Sometimes the index finger may rub or pull at the eye as the negative thoughts continue. This gesture is often mistaken as a signal of interest, but the supporting thumb under the chin tells the truth about the critical attitude. Taking a gesture cluster affects a person's attitude, so the longer a person holds it, the longer their critical attitude will remain. This gesture cluster is a signal that immediate action is required by the speaker, either by involving the listener in what he is saying or by ending the encounter. A simple move, such as handing something to the listener to alter his pose, can cause a change in attitude. The next time you have the opportunity to present an idea to a group of people, watch them carefully as you give your idea, and you may notice that many will bring one hand up to their face and use an evaluation gesture. When you come to the end of your presentation and ask the group to give opinions or suggestions, the evaluation gesture will usually stop and a chin-stroking gesture begins. This chin stroke is a signal that the listener is going through the decision-making process, and their next gestures will signal whether their decision is negative or positive. Your best strategy is to stay quiet and watch their next gestures, which will indicate the decision reached. For example, if the chin stroke is followed by crossed arms and legs and the person sits back in their chair, it's a fair bet the answer will be no. This gives you an early opportunity to resell the benefits before the other person verbalizes no and makes it harder to reach an agreement. If the chin stroke is followed by leaning forward with opened arms or picking up your proposal or sample, chances are you have a yes and you can proceed as if you have an agreement.
Like evaluation gestures, stalling gestures are easy to spot. Someone who wears glasses sometimes follows an evaluation cluster by taking off their glasses and putting one arm of the frame in the mouth instead of using the chin stroke when making their decision. A cigarette smoker will take a puff. When a person puts a pen or a finger in their mouth after you've asked for a decision, this is a signal that he's unsure or that reassurance is needed. The object in the mouth allows him to stall. Sometimes boredom, evaluation, and decision-making gestures come in combinations, each showing different elements of a person's attitude. While these gestures are quite simple to read, you mustn't jump to conclusions. We'll illustrate this with a story about a videotape role play we once conducted. Our interviewee suddenly covered his mouth and rubbed his nose after he'd been asked a question by the interviewer. He used the mouth cover for several seconds before answering, then returned to his open pose. Up to that point in the role play, the interviewee had kept his open posture with his coat unbuttoned, palms visible, nodding his head and leaning forward when he answered questions, so we thought the gestures might have been isolated or out of context. On reviewing the videotape, we asked him about the hand-to-mouth gesture, and he said that when he was asked the question, he thought he could have responded in one of two ways, one negative and one positive. As he thought about the negative answer and about how the interviewer might react to it, he covered his mouth. When he thought about the positive answer, however, his hand dropped away from his mouth and he resumed an open posture. His uncertainty about the interviewer's possible reaction to the negative reply had resulted in the sudden mouth cover. This illustrates how easy it can be to misinterpret a hand-to-face gesture and to jump to wrong conclusions.
There's an old saying, the eyes are the windows to the soul. And throughout history, we've been preoccupied with the eyes and their effect on human behaviour. Eye contact regulates conversation, gives cues of dominance, and can form the basis for suspecting a liar. Eye signals are a vital part of being able to read a person's attitude and thoughts. When people meet for the first time, they make a series of quick judgments about each other, based largely on what they see. We use phrases such as, she looked daggers at him, he had that gleam in his eyes, he has shifty eyes, or she gave him a look to kill. We say a person has Betty Davis eyes, Spanish eyes, bedroom eyes, beady, jealous, unforgiving and piercing eyes. When we use these phrases, we are unwittingly referring to the size of the person's pupils and to his gaze behaviour. The eyes can be the most revealing and accurate of all human communication signals because they are a focal point on the body and the pupil works independently of conscious control. In given light conditions, your pupils will dilate or contract as your attitude and mood change from positive to negative or vice versa. When someone becomes excited, their pupils can dilate up to 4 times their original size. Conversely, an angry, negative mood causes the pupils to contract to what are commonly known as beady little eyes or snake eyes. Lighter eyes can be more attractive because it's easier to see the dilation taking place. In general, pupil size increases when people view something that stimulates them, such as pictures of the opposite sex, or pleasant or unpleasant pictures including foods, political figures, a disabled child, or war scenes, or when listening to music. Hess found that increases in pupil size are positively correlated with mental activity associated with problem solving, reaching maximum dilation as a person arrives at the solution. We applied this research to the business world and demonstrated how people rate models in photographs as more attractive if the photo has been altered to make the pupil area larger. This is an effective way to increase the sales of any product that used a close-up of the face, such as women's cosmetics, hair products, and clothing. The eyes are a key signal in courtship, and the purpose of eye makeup is to emphasize eye display. If a woman is attracted to a man, she will dilate her pupils at him, and he is likely to decode this signal correctly without knowing it. This is why romantic encounters are most successful in dimly lit places, because everyone's pupils dilate and create the impression that couples are interested in each other.
Research has shown that when pornographic films are shown to men, a certain part of their body grows to almost 3 times its usual size. And that part, of course, is the pupils. They dilate. Most women's pupils gather the greatest dilation when looking at pictures of mothers and babies. Young babies and children have larger pupils than adults, and babies' pupils constantly dilate when adults are present in an attempt to look as appealing as possible and therefore receive constant attention. This is why the best-selling children's toys almost always have oversized pupils. Scientists don't yet know how this eye information is sent and decoded. They simply know that we can do it. The ability to decode pupil dilation is hardwired into the brain and happens completely automatically. When you're communicating or negotiating, look at the pupils and they will reveal the real feelings. Both sexes have a greater ability to decode eye signals than body signals, and women are better at it than men. Interestingly, humans are the only primates that have whites of the eyes. The white of the eye evolved as a communication aid to allow humans to see where other people were looking, because direction of gaze is linked to emotional states. Women's brains have more hardwiring than men's to read emotions, and one consequence of this is that women have more white of the eye than men. It's not just the eyes themselves that speak volumes. The eyebrow flash is a universal long-distance hello. It's a signal which is also used by monkeys and apes as a social greeting, confirming that it's an inborn gesture. The eyebrows rise rapidly for a split second, then drop again, and its purpose is to draw attention to the face so that clear signals can be exchanged. The only culture that doesn't use the eyebrow flash is the Japanese, where it's considered improper or impolite and has definite sexual connotations. This is an unconscious signal that acknowledges the other person's presence. The golden rule is always eyebrow flash those you like or the people you want to like you.
In our previous book, Why Men Lie and Women Cry, we show how women widen their eyes by raising their eyebrows and eyelids to create the baby face appearance of a small infant. This has a powerful effect on men by releasing hormones into the brain which stimulate the desire to protect and defend females. Lowering the head and looking up is another submissive gesture that appeals to men because it makes the eyes appear larger and makes a woman appear more childlike. This is because children are so much smaller than adults and spend their looking time gazing up, and this creates a parenting reaction in both men and women. Princess Diana made an art form of keeping her chin down while looking up and exposing her vulnerable neck. This childlike gesture cluster triggered maternal and paternal reactions towards her in millions of people. People who use these submissive gesture clusters usually don't practice them consciously, but they know when they use them, they get a result. It is only when you see eye to eye with another person that a real basis for communication can be established. Some people can make us feel comfortable when they talk with us. Others make us feel ill at ease, and some seem untrustworthy. Initially, this has to do with the length of time that they look at us and with how long they hold our gaze as they speak. In most Western and European cultures, to build a good rapport with another person, your gaze should meet theirs about 60 to 70% of the time. This will also cause them to begin to like you. It is not surprising, therefore, that the nervous, timid person who meets our gaze less than one-third of the time is rarely trusted. This is also why, in negotiations, dark-tinted glasses should be avoided, as they make others feel you are either staring at them or trying to avoid them.
There are three basic types of gazing. There's social gazing, intimate gazing, and power gazing. Number one is the social gaze. Experiments into gazing reveal that during social encounters, the gazer's eyes look in a triangular area on the other person's face between the eyes and the mouth for up to 90% of the gazing time. This is the area of the face that we're looking at in a non-threatening situation. When you do this, the other person will perceive you as non-aggressive. Number two is the intimate gaze. When people approach each other from a distance, they look quickly between the other person's face and lower body to first establish what sex the person is, and then a second time to determine their level of interest in them. This gaze travels across the eyes and below the chin to lower parts of the person's body. In close encounters, it's the triangular area between the eyes and the chest, and for distant gazing, it's from the eyes to the groin or below. Men and women use this gaze to assess interest in each other, and those who are interested will return the gaze. We usually give two quick glances and then look at their face. And despite most people's strong denials about it, hidden camera studies reveal that everyone does it, including nuns. You know, there's an old joke. Why do men have trouble making eye contact? because breasts don't have eyes. Like many jokes, this is based on the differences between men and women. Women have a wide-ranging peripheral vision which allows them to check out a man's body from head to toe without getting caught doing it. Male tunnel vision is why a man will move his gaze up and down a woman's body in a very obvious way. This is also the reason why men are constantly accused of ogling women's bodies at close range, but women are rarely accused of the same, even though research shows that women do more of it than men. It's not that men are bigger oglers than women. Men's tunnel vision means they keep getting caught. Gaze number three is the power gaze. I want you to now imagine that the person has a third eye in the centre of their forehead. Now look in the triangular area between the person's three eyes. The impact this gaze has on the other person has to be experienced to be believed. Not only does it change the atmosphere to very serious, it can stop a boar dead in their tracks. By keeping your gaze directed at this area, you keep the screws firmly on them. Provided your gaze doesn't drop below the level of their eyes, the pressure will stay on them. Never use this in friendly or romantic encounters, though. But it works a treat on the person who you want to intimidate, or on the person who just simply won't shut up. If you have soft, weak or wimpy eyes, practice using the power stare to give yourself more authority. When you're under attack from someone, try not to blink while maintaining eye contact. When you look at the attacker, narrow your eyelids and focus closely on that person. When you pan your eyes from one person to another, do it without blinking, and it has an unnerving effect on anyone who watches you do it. To do this, move your eyeballs first and then let your head follow, but your shoulders should remain still. Imagine you're Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Terminator. This is a great addition to your body language weapons arsenal.
As we have said, eye contact is one of the most important areas when analysing body language. Many people are taught that in sales or job interviews, you should maintain strong eye contact with the other person and keep it up until you are seated. This creates problems for both the interviewer and the interviewee because it's contrary to the process we like to go through when we first meet people. A man wants to check out a woman's hair, legs, body shape, and overall presentation. If she maintains eye contact, it restricts this process, so he's left trying to steal glances at her during the interview without getting caught, so he becomes distracted from the actual job of interviewing. Some women are disappointed that, in a supposedly equal business world, men still do this, but hidden cameras show this to be a fact of business life, whether we like it or not. Video evidence also reveals that women interviewers go through the same evaluation process with both male and female interviewees, but women's wider peripheral vision means that they rarely get caught. Women are also more critical than men of female interviewees whose appearance just doesn't stack up. Women look at male candidates' hair length, clothes designs and coordination, the creases in his trousers, and the shine on his shoes. Most men are completely unaware that women look at the condition of the back of the shoes as he walks out. The way to handle all of this is when you go for an interview, shake hands, and then give the interviewer a 2 to 3 second frame of uninterrupted time for them to complete the process of looking you over. Look down to open your briefcase or folder, or to arrange any papers you might need. Turn to hang up your coat or move your chair in closer and then look up. In filming sales interviews, we found that not only did the interviews feel better for the salesperson who used this strategy, it resulted in a better outcome in sales results.
Many people are becoming familiar with neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP as it's known. A person's eye movements can reveal what their mind is focusing on by indicating to you whether they're remembering something they've seen, heard, smelled, tasted, or touched. In simple terms, if a person is remembering something that they saw, their eyes will move upward. If they're recalling something they heard, their eyes will look to the side and they tilt their head as if they're listening. If they're recalling a feeling or emotion, They look down and to the right. When a person is mentally talking to themselves, they look down and to the left. These eye movements can occur in a fraction of a second and come in clusters, making it harder to read them live. A videotape replay, however, can let you see the discrepancies between what a person says and what they really think. NLP research has shown that 35% of people prefer the visual information channel and will use phrases such as, "I see what you mean," or "That's perfectly clear," and you'll get their attention by showing them photos, charts, graphs, and asking if they get the picture. 25% prefer the auditory channel and use words such as, "That rings a bell," "That doesn't sound right," and they want to be in tune with you. The other 40% prefer the feelings channel and will say things like, "Let's kick that idea around," "Our department needs a shot in the arm," "I can't quite grasp what you're saying." They love to test drive things and to be involved in a demonstration so that they can grasp the idea. NLP is a remarkable discovery, and we recommend you follow this up by reading more detailed studies.
So how can this knowledge about the importance of eye movement be used in day-to-day situations? Well, you can use it to hold eye contact with an audience. As professional conference speakers, we developed a technique for keeping an audience's attention and letting them feel involved. In groups of up to 50 people, it's possible to meet the gaze of each individual. In larger groups, you usually stand back further, so a different approach is needed. By pegging a real or imaginary point or person at each corner of the group and one in the centre, when you stand at a distance of 10 metres from the front row, approximately 20 people in a group of up to 50 will feel you are looking at them individually as you speak, so you can create an intimate bond with most of your audience. Another tip is that when you are giving a visual presentation using books, charts, graphs, or a laptop, it's important to know how to control where the other person is looking. Research shows that of the information relayed to the brain in visual presentations, 83% comes via the eyes, 11% via the ears, and 6% through the other senses. Research has shown that the retention of information from verbal presentations is only 10%. This means that a verbal presentation requires frequent repetition of key points to be effective. By comparison, the retention rate of combined verbal and visual presentation is 50%. This means you will achieve a 400% increase in efficiency through the use of visual aids. The study also found that using visual aids cuts the average business meeting time from 25.7 minutes to 18.6 minutes, a 28% time saving. Another tip is the power lift, where you keep control of where a person is looking. When sitting in a one-to-one situation, use a pen to point to the presentation and at the same time verbalize what he sees. Next, lift the pen from the presentation and hold it between his eyes and your eyes. This has a magnetic effect of lifting his head so that now he is looking at you and he sees and hears what you are saying, achieving maximum absorption of your message. Keep the palm of your other hand open when you are speaking. Interestingly, we found that women hold more direct eye contact than men during presentations, especially when they're not talking. When women are talking, however, they avert their eyes more than men do.
So, to summarise, where you direct your gaze has a powerful impact on the outcome of any face-to-face encounter. If you were a manager who was going to reprimand an errant subordinate or a parent reprimanding a child, which gaze would you use? If you used social gazing, then the sting would be taken out of your words, regardless of how direct or threatening you might try to sound. Social gazing would weaken your words, but intimate gazing would either intimidate or embarrass them. Power gazing, however, has a powerful effect on the receiver and tells them you mean business. What men describe as the come-on look that women use relates to a sideways glance, dilated pupils, and intimate gazing. If a woman wants to play hard to get, she needs to avoid using an intimate gaze and use a social gaze instead. But most men miss a lot of it anyway. to use a power gaze during courting would leave a man or woman labelled as cold or unfriendly. When you use an intimate gaze on a potential partner, however, you give the game away. Women are expert at sending and receiving this gaze, but unfortunately, most men are not. When men use the intimate gaze, it's usually blatantly obvious to women. But on the other hand, most men are generally unaware of having been given an intimate gaze by a woman, much to her frustration.
Let's move on to another very important aspect of body language, personal space. The world is full of clearly defined boundaries over which men have fought and died, and it's the same with one's own personal space or territory. This is the area or space around a person that he claims as his own, including the area that exists around his possessions, such as his home, the inside of his motor vehicle, his own bedroom or personal chair. In the early 1960s, American anthropologist Edward Hall discovered there is also a defined airspace around a person's body. In this section, we'll deal mainly with the implications of this airspace, how people react when it is invaded, and the importance of sometimes keeping an arm's-length relationship. Personal territory can expand or contract depending on the local circumstances. Like most animals, each human has his own personal portable air bubble, which he carries around with him. Its size is dependent on the density of the population in the place where he grew up. Personal space is therefore culturally determined. Whereas some cultures, such as the Japanese, are accustomed to crowding, others preferred the wide open spaces and they like you to keep your distance.
Let's discuss the radius of the air bubble around suburban, middle-class people living in Western and Northern European cultures. Children have learnt this spacing by age 12, and it can be broken down into four distinct zone distances. Starting from the closest, they are, first, the intimate zone. This is between 6 and 18 inches away, that's 15 to 45 centimetres. Of all the zone distances, this is by far the most important, as it's the zone that a person guards as if it was his own property. Only those who are emotionally close to us are permitted to enter. These include lovers, parents, spouse, children, close friends, relatives and pets. There is a subzone that extends up to 6 inches or 15 centimetres from the body that can be entered only during intimate physical contact. This is known as the close intimate zone.
Number 2 is the personal zone between 18 and 48 inches, say half to 1.3 metres. This is the distance we stand from others at cocktail parties, office parties, social functions and friendly gatherings.
Number 3 is the social zone, which is between 4 and 12 feet. That's 1.5 to 3 metres. We stand at this distance from strangers, a plumber or carpenter doing repairs around our home, the postman, the local shopkeeper, the new employee at work, and people whom we don't know very well.
Number 4, the public zone, which is more than 12 feet or 3.5 metres. Whenever we address a large group of people, this is the comfortable distance at which we choose to stand. All these distances tend to reduce between two women and increase between two men.
Our intimate zone, which is 6 to 18 inches away, or 15 to 45 centimetres, is normally entered by another person for one of two reasons. First, the intruder is a close relative or friend, or he or she may be making sexual advances. Second, the intruder is hostile and may be about to attack. While we tolerate strangers moving within our personal and social zones, the intrusion of a stranger into our intimate zone causes physiological changes to take place within our bodies. The heart pumps faster, adrenaline pours into the bloodstream, and blood is pumped to the brain and muscles as physical preparations for a possible fight or flight situation are made. This means that putting your arm, in a friendly way, around someone you've just met may result in that person feeling very negative towards you, even though they may smile and appear to enjoy it in order not to offend you. If you want people to feel comfortable around you, the golden rule is keep your distance. The more intimate our relationship is with other people, the closer they will permit us to move within their zones. For example, a new work employee may initially feel that the other staff members are cold towards him, but they're only keeping him in the social zone until they know him better. As he becomes better known to them, the distance between them decreases until eventually he's permitted to move within their personal zones, and in some cases, within their intimate zones. The distance that two people keep their hips apart when they embrace also reveals clues about the relationship between them. Lovers press their torsos against each other and move within each other's close intimate zones. This differs from the kiss received from a stranger on New Year's Eve, from your best friend's spouse, or your dear old Aunt Sally, all of whom keep their pelvic area at least 6 inches away from yours. Research has shown that the farther away from the brain a body part is positioned, the less awareness we have of what it's doing. For example, most people are aware of their face and what expressions and gestures they're displaying, and we can even practice some expressions that put on a brave face or give a disapproving look. We grin and bear it or look happy when Granny gives us another hideous birthday gift. After our face, we are less aware of our arms and hands, then our chest and stomach, and we are least aware of our legs and almost oblivious to our feet. The legs evolved in humans to serve two purposes: to move forward and get food, and to run away from danger. Because the human brain is hardwired for these two objectives, to go towards what we want and to move away from what we don't, the way a person uses their legs and feet reveals where they want to go. In other words, they show a person's commitment to leaving or staying in a conversation. Open or uncrossed leg positions show an open or dominant attitude, while crossed leg positions reveal closed attitudes and uncertainty. This means that the legs and feet are an important source of information about someone's attitude because most people are unaware of what they're doing with them and never consider faking gestures with them, in the way that they would with their face. A person can look composed and in control while their foot is repetitively tapping and revealing their frustration at not being able to escape. In the same way, a woman who's not interested in a man will fold her arms on her chest and cross her legs away from him, giving him the no-go body language, while an interested woman would open herself to him.
So let's have a look at how we use the lower halves of our body. There are four main standing positions. Number one is standing to attention. This is a formal position that shows a neutral attitude with no commitment to stay or go. In male-female encounters, it is used by women more than men as it effectively keeps the legs together like a no comment signal. School children use it when talking to a teacher. Junior officers use it when talking to senior officers. People meeting royalty do it, and employees use it when talking to the boss. Number two is standing with your legs apart. As mentioned earlier, this is predominantly a male gesture and is like a standing crotch display. The crotch displayer plants both feet firmly on the ground, making a clear statement that he has no intentions of leaving. It is used as a dominant signal by men because it projects a macho-looking attitude. Number three is the foot forward position. In this stance, the body weight is shifted to one hip, which leaves the front foot pointing forward. This is a valuable clue to a person's immediate intentions because we point our lead foot in the direction our mind would like to go, and this stance looks as if the person is beginning to walk. In a group situation, we point our lead foot at the most interesting or attractive person, but when we want to leave, we point our feet at the nearest exit. Position number four is the leg cross. The next time you attend a meeting with men and women, you will notice some groups of people standing with their arms and legs crossed, i.e. one leg bent at the knee with the lower leg crossing the shin of the straight leg. Look more closely and you'll also see that these people are standing at a greater distance from each other than the customary social distance. This is how most people stand when they are amongst people whom they don't know well. If you interact with them, you will find that one or all of them are unfamiliar with the others in the group. While uncrossed legs can show openness or dominance, crossed legs show a closed, submissive or defensive attitude as they symbolically deny any access to the genitals. For a woman, positions like the scissors, both legs straight but both legs crossed, and the single leg cross send two messages. One, that she intends to stay, not leave, and two, that access is denied. When a man does it, It also shows he'll stay but wants to be sure you won't kick him where it hurts. Open legs display masculinity, closed legs protect masculinity.
Imagine now that you notice another group of people standing with their arms unfolded, palms visible, a relaxed appearance, and are leaning back on one leg with the other one pointing towards others in the group. All are gesturing with their hands and are moving in and out of each other's personal space. Closer investigation would reveal that these people are friends or are known personally to each other. The first group, with the arms crossed and legs crossed, may have relaxed facial expressions and conversation that sounds free and easy, but the folded arms and legs tell us that they're not as relaxed and confident with each other as they would be trying to appear. Try this. Join a group where you know no one and stand with your arms and legs tightly crossed and wear a serious expression. One by one, the other group members will cross their arms and legs and remain in that position until you, the stranger, leave. Walk away and watch how, one by one, the members of the group assume their original poses once again. Crossing the legs not only reveals negative or defensive emotions, it makes a person appear insecure and causes others to react accordingly. As people begin to feel more comfortable in a group and get to know others, they move through a series of movements taking them from the defensive crossed arms and legs position to the relaxed open position. This opening up procedure follows the same sequence everywhere. It begins with the closed position with arms and legs crossed. As they begin to feel comfortable with each other and rapport builds, their legs uncross first and their feet are placed together in the attention position. Next, the arm folded on top of the arm cross comes out and the palm is occasionally flashed when speaking, but is eventually not used as a barrier. Instead, it may hold the outside of the other arm in a single arm barrier. Both arms unfold next, and one arm gestures or may be placed on the hip or in the pocket. Finally, one person takes a foot forward position, showing acceptance of the other person.
Just to slightly complicate things, there are different types of seated leg cross positions that you need to watch out for. In the European leg cross, one leg is crossed neatly over the other, with 70% of people crossing left over right. This is the normal crossed leg position used by European, Asian, and British cultures. When a person crosses both legs and arms, they have emotionally withdrawn from the conversation and it can be futile to try and be convincing when they sit like this. In business contexts, we have found that people sitting like this talk in shorter sentences, reject more proposals, and can recall less detail of what was discussed than those who sit with their arms and legs in an open position. Next up is the American figure four, where one leg is bent and crossed over the other with the ankle resting on the bent knee of the opposite leg. This is still relatively uncommon in Britain and Europe among older people, but it is now seen in diverse cultures such as Russia, Japan, Sardinia, and Malta among the younger generations who are addicted to American films and television and are now mirroring what they see. This position is a seated version of a crotch display as it highlights the genitals and is used by mainly American males to show an argumentative or competitive attitude. Studies also show that most people make most of their final decision when both feet are on the ground, so the figure four is not conducive to asking someone to make a decision. Some people turn the figure four into a permanent position using one or both hands as a clamp. This is a sign of a tough-minded, stubborn individual who rejects any opinion other than their own. Research shows that when the mind closes, the body follows. So if you're trying to persuade someone who sits in any of these cross-legs positions, you should attempt to get them to uncross before continuing. If you have something to show, invite them to sit beside you or give them things to do or to hold so that they can lean forward to write notes or hold brochures or samples. And by the way, offering tea or coffee also works well as it makes it hard for a person to cross their arms and legs without burning themselves.
Another leg gesture to watch for is the ankle lock, where one ankle is crossed over the other. The male version of the ankle lock is often combined with clenched fists resting on the knees, or with hands tightly gripping the arms of the chair, or a seated crotch display. The female version varies slightly. The knees are held together, the feet may be to one side, and the hands rest side by side or on top of one another, resting on the upper legs. Over 3 decades of interviewing and selling to people, we've noted that when an interviewee locks his ankles, he's mentally biting his lip. This gesture shows that he's holding back a negative emotion, uncertainty, or fear. The feet are usually withdrawn under the chair, showing that the person also has a withdrawn attitude. When people are involved in a conversation, they also put their feet into the conversation. Researchers found that by using questioning techniques, you can often encourage people to unlock their ankles and become more open and involved. In the initial stages of studying the ankle lock, we found that asking questions had a 42% success rate in getting interviewees to relax and unlock their ankles. We discovered, however, that if an interviewer walks around to the interviewee's side of the desk and sits beside him, removing the desk as a barrier, the interviewee would often relax and unlock his ankles, and the conversation would take on a more open, personal tone. Women who wear miniskirts cross their legs and ankles for obvious, necessary reasons. But through years of habit, however, many older women will still sit in this position, which can not only make them feel restrained, but others are likely to unconsciously read it as negative and react towards these women with caution. The leg twine gesture is almost exclusively used by women and is the trademark of a shy, timid woman or a part-time contortionist. The top of one foot wraps around the other leg to reinforce an insecure attitude and shows she's retreated into her shell like a tortoise, despite how relaxed her upper body may appear. A warm, friendly, low-key approach is needed if you eventually hope to open this clam. A popular leg gesture for women is parallel legs, where the legs are crossed above the knee so that both lower legs are almost parallel with each other, usually angled at 45 degrees. Because of the bone configuration of female legs and hips, it becomes a powerful signal of femininity because most men can't do it. Not surprisingly, over 86% of male participants in our leg rating surveys voted parallel legs as the most attractive female sitting position. One leg presses against the other and gives the legs a healthier, more youthful look, which appeals to men from a reproductive standpoint. This is the position taught to women in deportment and modelling classes. Parallel legs should not be confused with the woman who constantly crosses and uncrosses her legs when she's with the man she fancies. This is done to draw attention to her legs. Another important point to keep in the back of your mind is that when we're interested in either a conversation or a person, we put one foot forward to shorten the distance between us and that person. If we're reticent or not interested, we put our feet back, usually under a chair if we're seated. Typical male courtship body language gestures include foot forward, legs apart, crotch display, and arms splayed to try to enlarge the overall perceived size and take up more space. Typical female no-go body language signals include legs together, body facing away, arms folded, and minimizing the amount of space she occupies, so he's probably wasting his time.
So, to recap, our feet tell others where we want to go and who we do and don't like. If you're a woman, avoid crossing your legs when you're sitting with businessmen unless you're wearing a long dress. The rule here is simple. For social contexts, exposed cross legs are fine, but don't do it in business. If you're a man dealing with women in business, the same rule applies. Keep your knees together. Male crotches intimidate.
End of Disc 2. Now let's look at some gestures involving the body. The hands on hips gesture is a regularly seen gesture that shows we're ready for action. To appear bigger for fighting and courting rituals, birds will fluff their feathers and cats and dogs will make their fur stand on end. The hairless human, however, no longer has a thick pelt to expand to make himself look more imposing when he's feeling fearful or angry. When we describe a scary movie, we often say, "It made my hair stand on end." If we become angry with someone, "He made the hackles on my neck rise." And when we're smitten with someone, they give us goosebumps. All these are the body's mechanical reactions to circumstances in which we attempt to make ourselves appear larger and are caused by the erector pili muscles on the skin, which attempt to make our non-existent pelt stand up. Modern humans, however, have invented a gesture to help them achieve a bigger physical presence, the hands-on-hips gesture. Hands-on-hips is used by the child arguing with his parent, the athlete waiting for his event to begin, the boxer waiting for the bout to start, and males who want to issue a non-verbal challenge to other males who might want to enter their territory. In each instance, the person takes the hands on hips pose, and this is a universal gesture used to communicate that a person is ready for assertive action. It lets the person take up more space and has the threat value of the pointed elbows that act as weapons, preventing others from approaching or passing. The arms being half raised shows readiness for attack, and this is a position taken by cowboys in a gunfight, particularly when it's pointed at the intended victim. It's used everywhere, and in the Philippines and Malaysia, it carries the even stronger message of anger or outrage. Occasionally, the gesture may be done with only one hand on the hip, and the other displaying another gesture, and this is commonly used by women who want to draw attention to themselves by using this cluster with a pelvic tilt to emphasize their hips-to-waist ratio, which indicates fertility. Hands on hips is regularly used by both men and women in courtship to draw attention to themselves. Let's now look at how we build rapport with our fellow human beings, and this can be summed up with that one word, mirroring. When we meet others for the first time, we need to assess quickly whether they are positive or negative towards us, just as most other animals do for survival reasons. We do this by scanning the other person's body to see if they move or gesture in the same way we do in what is known as mirroring. We mirror each other's body language as a way of bonding, for being accepted, and to create rapport, but we are usually oblivious to the fact we're doing it. Mirroring makes others feel at ease and creates good vibes. It's such a powerful rapport-building tool that slow-motion video research reveals that it even extends to simultaneous blinking, nostril flaring, simultaneous eyebrow raising, and even pupil dilation, which is remarkable because these micro-gestures cannot be consciously imitated. Studies into synchronous body language behavior show that people who are feeling similar emotions or are on the same wavelength and are likely to be experiencing a rapport will also begin to match each other's body language and expressions. Being in sync to bond with another person begins early in the womb, when our body functions and heartbeat match the rhythm of our mother, so mirroring is a state to which we are naturally inclined. Because of the phenomenon of cause and effect, if you intentionally assume certain body language positions, you will begin to experience the emotions associated with those gestures. For example, if you feel confident, you may unconsciously assume the steeple gesture to reflect your confidence. But if you intentionally steeple, you will not only begin to feel more confident, others will perceive that you're more confident. This then becomes a powerful way to create rapport with others by intentionally matching their body language and posture. Let's move on to a very important part of body language, courtship displays and attraction signals. Dr. Albert Shefflin, the author of Body Language and the Social Order, found that when a person enters the company of the opposite sex, certain physiological changes take place. He found that high muscle tone became evident in preparation for a possible sexual encounter, any bagging around the face and the eyes decreased, body sagging disappeared, the chest protruded, the stomach was automatically pulled in, pot-bellied slumping disappeared, the body assumed an erect posture, and the person appeared to become more youthful in appearance. A man will stand taller, protrude his jaw, and expand his chest to make himself appear more dominant. A woman who's interested will respond by emphasizing her breasts, tilting her head, touching her hair, exposing her wrists, and thereby making herself appear submissive. The ideal place to observe these changes is on a beach, when a man and woman approach each other from a distance. The changes take place when they're close enough to meet each other's gaze and will continue until after they've passed each other, at which time their original postures return. Body language is a fundamental part of courtship because it reveals how available, attractive, ready, enthusiastic, sexy, or desperate we are. While some courtship signals are studied and deliberate, others, such as those just mentioned, are completely unconscious. It's still unclear how we learn these signals, but research now shows that many may well be inborn. The bottom line is that when a person wants to attract the opposite sex, they do so by emphasizing sexual differences. To discourage the opposite sex, we play down or hide these differences.
The success women have in intimate encounters is directly related to their ability to send courtship signals to men and to decode those being sent back. For a man, success in the mating game relies mainly on his ability to read the signals being sent to him as opposed to being able to initiate his own moves. Most women are aware of courtship signals, but men are far less perceptive, often being completely blind to them, which is why so many men have difficulty finding potential mates. Women's difficulty in finding partners is not about reading signals, it's more about finding a man who'll match their criteria. Ask any man who usually makes the first move in courtship and he will invariably say that men do. All studies into courtship, however, show that women are the initiators 90% of the time. A woman does this by sending a series of subtle eye, body, and facial signals to the targeted man who, assuming he is perceptive enough to pick up, responds to them. There are men who will approach women in a bar or a club without being sent the green light. While some of these men are regularly successful with finding partners, their overall statistical success rate is low because they weren't invited first. They're simply playing the numbers game. In these cases, if a man detects that his approach will be unsuccessful, he's likely to pretend he's come to talk to her about other unrelated things, and he will usually use corny lines like, "You work at the National Bank, don't you?" or "Aren't you John Smith's sister?" To be successful in courtship by playing the numbers game, a man has to approach a lot of women to make a sale, unless, of course, he looks like Brad Pitt. Any man who crosses the floor to chat up a woman has usually done so at her request after picking up her body language signals. It just looks as if he made the first move because he made the walk across the floor. Women do initiate up to 90% of flirtatious encounters, but it is done so subtly that most men think they are the ones taking the lead.
Now let's look at what men look for in women's bodies, and vice versa. The research is clear. Men's brains are wired to be attracted to women who show the most healthy reproductive ability and sexual availability. When it comes to body shape, both men and women prefer someone with an athletic body shape. To men, this signals high levels of health and a woman's ability to successfully reproduce his genes. Evidence shows that men are more attractive to women with childlike faces, large eyes, small noses, full lips and cheeks, because these signals evoke paternal, protective feelings in most men. This is why most advertising for cosmetic surgery places so much emphasis on these features. Women, conversely, prefer men with adult faces that show the ability to defend, strong jaws, larger brows, and strong nose. The good news is that a woman doesn't need to be naturally beautiful to attract a man, though beauty certainly does give her an initial edge over competitors. She needs mainly to be able to display the signs that she could be available. This is why some women who are not particularly physically attractive always seem to have plenty of suitors. Overall, a man is more attracted to a woman by the signs of her availability than by her physical attractiveness, and you can learn to practice availability signals. Some women are appalled by the idea of modern men being initially attracted to a woman based on her appearance and her availability, instead of wanting her for her ability to nurture, communicate, and be a domestic goddess or play the piano. They see discussions on this subject as degrading to modern women. The reality is, you need to attract a man first before he can find out about all your inner virtues. When you go fishing, you bait the hook with what the fish likes, not what you like. Have you ever tasted a worm? You'd probably be repulsed by the thought, but for a fish, it's his favourite dish. We've looked at male and female courtship rituals, so now let's move on to ownership and territory. We stake a physical claim on what we believe is ours. We lean against other people or objects to show territorial claim to that person or object. Leaning against something can also be used as a method of dominance or intimidation if the object being leaned on belongs to someone else. Lovers hold hands or put their arms around each other in public to show competitors they have a claim over that person. The business executive puts his feet on his desk or leans against his office doorway to show his claim to that office and its furnishings. A woman dusts imaginary pieces of lint off the shoulder of her husband to tell other women he's taken. An easy way to intimidate someone is to lean against, sit on, or use their possessions without their permission. In addition to the obvious abuse of another's territory or possession, such as sitting at his desk or borrowing his car without asking, there are many other subtle intimidation techniques, including leaning against his doorway or sitting in his chair. Historically, raising or lowering the height of your body in front of another person has been used as a means of establishing a superior-subordinate relationship. Think of the protest rally speaker who stands on a soapbox to be higher than everyone else, the judge who sits higher than the rest of the court, or the Olympic gold medal winner who stands higher than the other medal winners. Now let's look at the body language associated with dining. The shape of a family dining room table can give a clue to the power distribution in that family, assuming that the dining room could have accommodated a table of any shape and that the table shape was selected after considerable thought. Open families go for round tables, closed families select square tables, and authoritative types select rectangular tables. Next time you have a dinner party, try this experiment. Place the shyest, most introverted guest at the head of the table, furthest from the door, with their back to a wall. You will be amazed to see how simply placing a person in a powerful sitting position encourages them to begin to talk more often and with more authority, and how others will also pay more attention to them. If you're going to do business over dinner, it's a wise strategy to complete most of the conversation before the food arrives. After everyone starts eating, the conversation can come to a standstill, and alcohol dulls the brain. After you've eaten, the stomach takes blood away from the brain to help digestion, making it harder for people to think clearly. While some men hope to achieve these type of effects with a woman on a date, it can be disastrous in business. Present your proposals while everyone is mentally alert. Getting a decision in your favour is easier when the other person is relaxed and his defensive barriers have been lowered. To achieve this end, a few simple rules need to be followed. First, whether you're dining at home or at a restaurant, have the other person sitting with his back to a solid wall or screen. Research shows that respiration, heart rate, brainwave frequencies, and blood pressure all rapidly increase when a person sits with his back to an open space, particularly where others are moving about. Tension is further increased if a person's back is towards an open door or a window at ground level. So this is a good position to seat someone you want to unnerve or rattle. Next, the lights should be dimmed and gentle background music should be played to relax the senses. It would be best to use a round table and to have the other person's view of other people obscured by a screen or a large green plant if you want to have a captive audience. To summarise, seating positions should not be accidental. Placing certain people in specific positions can affect the outcome of a meeting. The next time you go to a meeting with anyone, ask yourself, who is the person you want to influence most and where is the best position to sit them to achieve this? If there's no appointed leader, who has claimed a seating position to give themselves the most power? The answers to these questions will not only give you a powerful edge, they will prevent others from trying to dominate or control a meeting.
Understanding body language gestures can have a major impact in interviews and office politics. Most of the factual information that comes from the CV, and that's the real stuff about the candidate that is a good indicator of performance, is forgotten if your first impression is not a good one. You don't get a second chance to make a first impression, and your approach, handshake, and overall body language are the key factors in deciding the outcome. Let's assume you're going to an interview and you want to make the best first impression. Keep in mind that others form up to 90% of their opinion about you in the first 4 minutes, and that 60 to 80% of the impact you will make is non-verbal. Here are the 9 golden keys to getting it right first time in an interview. 1. Remove your outerwear and leave it in the reception area so you can avoid entering an office with your arms full of clutter. Always stand in a reception area. Stand with hand in hand behind your back for confidence and slowly rock back and forward on your feet and feel confident and controlled.
2. Your entry tells others how you expect to be treated. Don't stand in the doorway like a naughty schoolchild waiting to see the headmaster. When you walk through the door of a person's office, maintain the same speed. People who lack confidence change gears and perform a kind of small shuffle as they enter.
3. Even if the person is on the phone, rummaging through a drawer or tying his shoelaces, walk in directly and confidently with a smooth motion. Put down your briefcase, folder or whatever is in your hands, shake the person's hand and immediately take a seat. Let the other person see that you are accustomed to walking confidently into offices.
4. For the handshake, keep your palm straight and return the pressure you receive. Let the other person decide when to end the handshake. Step to the left of a rectangular desk as you approach to avoid being given a palm-down handshake. Never shake directly across a desk. Use a person's name twice in the first 15 seconds and never talk for more than 30 seconds at a time.
5. If you are compelled to sit in a low chair directly facing the other person, turn it away 45 degrees from the person to avoid being stuck in the reprimand position. If you can't angle the chair, angle your body instead.
6. If you're invited to sit in an informal area in the person's office, such as at an informal coffee table, this is a positive sign because 95% of business rejections are delivered from behind a desk. Sit upright on the edge of a sofa so that you can control your body language and gestures, and angle your body to 45 degrees away from the person.
7. People who are cool, calm, collected, and in control of their emotions use clear, uncomplicated, deliberate movements. Remember that high-status individuals use fewer gestures than low-status individuals. Mirror the person's gestures and expressions when appropriate.
8. Respect the other person's personal space, which will be largest in the opening minutes of the meeting. If you move too close, the person will respond by sitting back, leaning away, or using repetitive gestures such as drumming the fingers.
9. When it's time to leave, pack your things calmly and deliberately, not in a frenzy. Shake hands if possible, turn and walk out. Remember, people always watch you from behind as you leave, so if you're a man, make sure you have shined the back of those shoes. As mentioned earlier, others study your rear as you depart, whether you like it or you don't. When you get to the door, turn around slowly and smile. It's far better that they recall your smiling face than your rear end. If someone keeps you waiting for more than 20 minutes, it shows either they're disorganized or it could be a form of power play. Keeping someone waiting is an effective way of reducing their status and enhancing the status of the person who is making them wait. So always take a book, PDA, laptop or office work, which shows that you too are busy and are not prepared to be inconvenienced.
Finally, here's a summary of the key points for making positive body language impressions on others. 1. Your face. Have an animated face and make smiling a part of your regular repertoire. Make sure you flash your teeth. 2. Your gestures. Be expressive, but don't overdo it. Keep your fingers closed when you gesture, your hands below chin level, and avoid arm and feet crossing. 3. Your head movement. Use triple nods when talking and the head tilt when listening. Keep your chin up. 4. Your eye contact. Give the amount of eye contact that makes everyone feel comfortable. Unless looking at others is a cultural no-no, lookers gain more credibility than non-lookers. 5. Your posture. Lean forward when listening. Stand straight when speaking. 6. Your territory. Stand as close as you feel comfortable. If the other person moves back, don't step forward again. And 7. Mirror. Subtly mirror the body language of others.
So that's it. We just want to add a thought for those who feel that learning body language skills is somehow manipulative or insincere. We believe that learning to be proficient at reading and using body language is no different to wearing certain types of clothes, using certain language, or telling stories that put you in the best light. If you study it, it won't happen unconsciously, and you will make a better impression on others.
So best of luck and enjoy your new power.